Going back to Neil, what sort of assumptions did you have, you know, prior to engaging with him and meeting him and getting onto it, and were they overturned or confirmed, you know, after you yeah. started to work with him?
Well, you know, that's a very good question. I'm not sure. I mean, I guess the assumptions I went in with was, you know, I thought he would be difficult to talk to, you know, since he had not agreed to many interviews. I was afraid that he would be hard to talk to, and that he wouldn't open up, that he would hold back a lot of things, and that he would be suspicious a lot of my questions. But I'll tell you, it didn't turn out to be that way at all. I mean, Neil and I developed a pretty quick and good rapport. And I think partly, he grew up in northwestern Ohio. You know, that's where Wapakoneta is located. And I grew up in northeastern Indiana. I grew up probably 60 to 70 miles from where he grew up, across the state line. And so even the way we spoke, accents, his parents were, came from farming families. And my background, both of my parents grew up on farms. And I had done all this work that had related to, you know, NASA and the NACA and aeronautical R&D. You know, we just kind of hit it off. I mean, both professionally and personally, and really from the start, you know, I had no trouble talking to him at all. I mean, it takes you a little bit of time, and because, you know, when you first meet him, you know, you're a little bit awestruck. I mean, here's a world famous person, and you know, you're in his home and you're shaking his hand, and you know, it takes a while to get over it. And then, of course, a lot of people could never get over it because they never had enough time with him to get over it. But yeah. I pretty quickly did. I mean, the very first meeting with him before he decided to give me the green light, you know, I spent about 4 hours with him in his living room talking with him and his wife. And I got comfortable pretty quickly because, you know, I could tell he was growing in his confidence. You know, if you're an interviewer, a historian, you know, if you're not asking good questions, if you're not asking informed questions, the person that you're talking to is going to shut down pretty quickly.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, they're going to know you don't know what in the heck you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so, I mean, I think because of my background and that I'd worked for 20 years, I taught these courses, and I knew a lot of people that Neil knew, I mean, or that Neil knew about.
Oh, I see.
In fact, I can tell you, when I was talking to him that very first day, and when I'd been at NASA Langley, you know, for the first years of my career, I mentioned to him the chief test pilot at Langley, a man by the name of Jack Reeder. And Jack, you know, that's not a name, you probably don't recognize it, and I don't think most, not even, you know, a lot of the experts in American aeronautical history would recognize it, but Jack was a really outstanding NASA test pilot, flew just everything from World War II right up to his retirement in the 70s. And when I mentioned the name Jack Reeder to Neil that first meeting, and I remember Carol, his wife, was in the room with us, I mentioned Jack Reeder, and Neil immediately turned, I could tell he knew him, he kind of, his face lit up, and he turned to Carol. And he said to Carol, Jack Reeder, it was the best test pilot I ever knew.
Is that right?
And then he turned to me and he said, and Chuck Yeager was the worst. And
fantastic.
I think I had him right there. I mean, I think the fact that I knew Jack Reeder and that I appreciated Jack Reeder for being a great test pilot, you know, I think that kind of clinched it for me right there, because Neil had the same kind of appreciation for Jack that I did. And he knew that if I understood why Jack was a great test pilot and why Chuck Yeager wasn't, then I was OK. You know, I'd passed that test.
Fantastic. So what was Neil's sort of home daily life like? I mean, the impression that a lot of people had of him was that he was a recluse, he couldn't get out the front door, you know, what was he like? I mean, could he go to the hardware store and get a packet of screws?
Well, he could. I mean, there were some tough moments for sure. I mean, people in the neighborhood, he lived in a suburb of Cincinnati, and of course, you know, people around him knew it and were somewhat protective of him. The local fire department, you know, I forget, there was some sort of a security alarm or something went off once, and the fire trucks arrived at the Armstrong home, and the firemen came in, and I mean, they knew that they were entering Neil Armstrong's house, you know. Right. And so it was that sort of thing happened. But he lived more normally than you would imagine. I mean, he lived in a comfortable ranch style home. You know, nothing luxurious about it. Just a very comfortable kind of ranch house in a suburb. He read a lot, and so you know he had a very nice library in his home. He loved to play golf. Mm-hmm. He was just a few minutes from the local golf club, and he would play when, of course, Cincinnati, the weather there is, you know, it has a winter, so there's several months of the year you're not playing golf, but Neil liked to play a lot of golf, and he and Carol traveled a lot. I mean, they were not leading anything close to a reclusive life. Mm. I mean, as I said, and as you know, I mean, a couple of trips to Australia, you know, in the years right before his death, you know, they were going to, you know, all around the world, really. And normally it was an event that Neil was asked to do, and he turned down a lot of events because he was asked to do so many, but he accepted a lot of them as well. And so they traveled, and every summer he would take one or the other of his sons to Ireland or Scotland on a golf trip.
Oh, right.
Whole family played golf. In fact, his one boy, Mark, played at Stanford University, which is where Tiger Woods played. So he was quite a good golfer. Mm. But you know, back to, you know, there were some things they had to watch out for. I mean, there were some kooks. There was this guy named Bart Sibrel who made a bunch of videos that argued that the moon landings were a big hoax.
Oh, yeah. When the Fox Network, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah. He'd bring his Bible along and accost, you know, Apollo astronauts in airports or wherever. He did it to Neil a couple of times. In fact, he tried to rent driveway space near Neil's house, you know, so he could get video footage of Neil. And he parked out in front of Neil's house. And there was one, you know, Neil and Carol told me about one kind of, they got in their car one day not knowing that he was nearby, and then he started to follow them, and they knew it, and there was kind of like a high-speed chase
through this
village of, you know, in suburban Cincinnati. So there were, and then he told me a story about a guy that was following them from airport to airport, you know, that they were making a trip, and it was required a couple of different stops, and this guy was, you know, was there every time they, you know, got to a new airport, and they had to call the security in for that.
Wow.
So, you know, yeah, he had to be kind of on the lookout. On the other hand, you know, since he had been out of the public eye so much over the years, you know, not doing that many public events, he could go out, you know, and people wouldn't even know. I mean, they didn't know what Neil Armstrong looked like.
Sure, sure.
I remember going with him one night after a day's interview. We went to a local ice cream shop. And we were in a fairly long line for an ice cream cone. There must have been 25 people waiting for an ice cream cone. And, you know, I got a kick out of it because, you know, nobody in the ice cream shop knew that Neil Armstrong was in there. You know, there'd been, you know, just a mass raid on him if they had found out. There we were standing, just waiting. And he ordered his ice cream and, you know, no one thought twice about it. So he could do that. He could do that as well. He kind of had both extremes going on.
Sure. That's fascinating. We're going to run out of time. We're going to pick this up in a second session, Jim, if you don't mind. Thank you for speaking to the Space Show, and we'll come back and maybe pick up a little bit more about some of your other work and what's coming up, and maybe a little bit more about Neil.
That'd be good. Thank you.
Speak soon.